You're listening to Solidarity Spokane, KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm your host, Cat Sabotage. Give me a moment to get set up, and I'm going to be right with you. Yes, Noam Chomsky is a soft revolution. If you don't know the man, pick up a book, Google him real quick. I learned a lot from him, and he's fantastic. That's why I like to revisit that song on the show. Good afternoon, fellow workers. I'm broadcasting to you live from the KYRS studio in the downtown Spokane Public Library. And we got a good show for you today. I was able to conduct an interview this week with author Christopher Scott Thompson, author of the book Pagan Anarchism. More on that to come here in just a little bit. I wanted to preface today's interview, which is going to be pre-recorded, with just a little bit of context, because you might wonder, this is a labor hour, so what are we doing talking about paganism and anarchism? Well, just to start, the concept of anarchy has deep, deep roots to the progressive left and the workers' movements of the 20th and 21st centuries. It has been vehemently, vehemently repressed, eradicated, rooted out, however you want to look at it. Anarchists got a bad rap. There were a ton of what you would call bomb and stick anarchists who believed in overthrowing the systems of government using violent means. However, some of you may not know that there is a living and breathing system of anarchy or ideals of anarchy, which are more closely related to pacifism and that do believe in toppling oppressive systems, but don't believe in doing it through violent means. So we're going to have a little bit of a talk about what anarchy is in practical terms and why we're even discussing it. When Marxism was in its nascent birthing era in the 20th century, there were some philosophers. Proudhon is one that you could note. Also Kropotkin. Please give them a Google. We're not going to get into the nitty-gritties of the philosophy and the ins and outs of that because I want you to stay awake through the program, but there is good stuff in there, and I would encourage you to read summaries and dig a little deeper if you are so inclined. But these fantastic men did not believe that a true utopia or workers' utopia could be created with the existence of a state, that is, a state government. They believed that those state governments would always become oppressive and they would always subjugate the will of the workers and the will of the people. So what does this future look like in anarchy? Well, quick look online is going to tell you that anarchy is the first definition, a state of disorder due to absence or non-recognition of authority or controlling systems. Some people also think of like punk rock anarchy, which is grabbing a can of spray paint and just making your voice heard on whatever piece of municipal equipment you happen to be closest by. I'm not advocating for that. I'm just saying kind of comes to mind. The other definition is the organization of society on the basis of voluntary cooperation without political institutions or hierarchical government. And that is the definition that we're going to run with today. So in an anarchist society, you don't have what we would call coercive institutions of power and authority dictating what people are doing. Rather, you have voluntary cooperation of individuals at the bottom forming voluntary combinations or organizations among themselves and then federating those organizations into a hierarchical structure that is responsive to what is going on at the bottom. So you have my particular brand that I love is anarcho-syndicalism, or the idea that there are many, many different kinds of workers in the economy and that those workers can operate in federated locals amongst themselves. They can basically come and go as they please, do what they like, and they are democratic institutions. They are put to the will and the consensus of the governed. It also takes place on a community level. I think that a lot of the problems that are related to our current economy and our current structure arise because institutions are too big, too cumbersome, not responsive to the needs of the people that they serve. And that's a pretty neat idea. And it is worth noting that the transition from a state society to an anarchistic society is not going to be easy. It's not going to be done overnight. And I doubt it will happen in our lifetime. Or you can imagine living in a city or an organization where everybody grows their own food. There are worker co-ops that grow their own food. There are municipal services which are provided at the will and behest of the people. And people, one of the theories that you have to kind of accept is that people naturally want to be productive and they want to work and they want to be a part of this economy. Many people will disparage some of our unemployed or unhoused individuals in our society and say, well, why don't they go get a job? Well, our beautiful economy, as it is immaculately designed, doesn't always have jobs that are going to fit for those folks. In this kind of society, people would find work for them. And indeed, in feudal societies, a lot of folks that we would now consider disabled were able to find meaningful and gainful work. I should note that anarchy is as far left as you can go. When people call the Democratic Party communists, or they call them, you know, all of those nasty grub trigger words, they really have no concept of what the left actually is. If they knew that anarchy was a part of that, they might be a little more grateful for the Joe Bidens of the world. I should also note that in America, you might be confusing libertarianism with anarchism. The American brand of libertarianism is a little bit different because it is highly steeped in individualism and the idea that everyone is out for themselves, whereas anarchistic principles are that society is on the basis of voluntary cooperation. Later to come in the interview with Christopher Scott Thompson, we do discuss that. We also discuss branches of anarcho-capitalism, which Chris points out astutely, they are not actually anarchists. You can't really support an institution of coercive power of employers and corporations over people without the oversight of government. I think we all know how that goes. If this were a video program, I would just zoom in on the picture of a child miner from 1872 or 1873 with a pipe in his mouth, and I think that about covers that. I'm kind of trying to hit this time on the nose here for the time of the interview. We got about 43 minutes in the chair with Chris, and I'm grateful for the time that we got, so I'm just going to jump into it. I think I've prefaced enough, but I should swing back around and talk about why paganism comes into this. Paganism is a beautiful, beautiful practice that I have learned a lot about, both from my partner and from folks around and in the community. As we move into a more secular world, we're also seeing a new resurgence in I will say alternative spiritualism, where people are turning to non-traditional methods to find spiritual satisfaction. And I'm in full support of any fellow workers who are questioning of their faith or want to explore different ways that we can create, we can interact with this human experience that we got. It can be a very daunting task when you look around and you wonder, what is it all for? What are we doing? Where do I find my purpose? And I believe Mr. Thompson explains beautifully how he found his. And I would encourage anybody to just have a look around and, you know, find what is good for you. We have freedom of religion in this country, ostensibly, or we should, perhaps. I don't know if that's taking too hard of a position or not, but from my, at least, opinion, not reflecting the opinions of anybody else, but just mine, I believe anybody should be free to practice whatever religion they want, and we show solidarity with every single individual who is practicing of any faith, because nobody is really sure why we're here or what we're doing. So if it jives with you, it jives with me. So without further ado, I'm going to get my interview with Christopher Scott Thompson on the air here. There's going to be a couple interesting little breaks here as I have to break at 20 and 40 after the hour, just for your local promos and all of that good stuff. I will do my best to introduce what is happening and what is coming along for some semblance of linear progression here. But without further ado, my time with Christopher Scott Thompson, the author of Pagan Anarchism. Chris, I know you're listening. Thank you very much for your time. You're listening to Solidarity Spokane, KYRS Medical Lake, Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm your host, Kat Sabotage, and today I am joined by... All right, we just had a brief timeout on playing the file. Give me just 1 second to figure out what I'm doing here, and I'll be right back with you. You're listening to Solidarity Spokane, KYRS Medical Lake, Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm your host, Kat Sabotage, and today I am joined by author, pagan, and anarchist from St. Paul, Minnesota, Christopher Scott Thompson. We have Christopher on air talking about his book, Pagan Anarchism, and I'm just very, very honored that he took the time to sit with us today. Hi, Chris. It's nice to meet you.
Hi, it's nice to meet you, too.
So you have created an absolutely beautiful, beautiful book. The ideas that you explore in it, and the way that you talk about your relationship with paganism, and the philosophies of anarchism, and the interplay between them, and the development of each throughout history is truly a compelling piece. And I just wanted to know, at first, just a little bit more about your roots. Like, what do you think led you into paganism and anarchism later as a philosophy? And did one kind of start first and influence the other, or what was that like for you?
I would say that they started separately, but then it was kind of like lines that start off parallel and then eventually start to creep closer together. Mm-hmm. As far as paganism goes, I've probably told this story before online somewhere, and you know how it goes when you remember something from far back in the past, you don't always remember it the same way twice. So if I'm telling the story differently than I've told it before, well, they're probably both wrong. But the version that I remember is that I was getting, I had some kind of an arrangement with either my parents or my grandparents where if I read a certain number of books, I would get a reward. And of course, I read all the time, so it wasn't going to be difficult for me to get the reward, but it was still like a fun goal to meet to get this reward.
Yeah.
So my grandparents wanted me to read the Bible, and of course, that had a huge number of books in it, so that was their actual motivation for the whole thing. And so they wanted me to read all the books of the Bible, and I was willing to do that. But then I thought it might be fun to read Bullfinch's Mythology as well. So I'm sitting there reading Bullfinch's Mythology, and I thought, you know what? I liked this idea a lot better than I like what I was reading in the Bible. So I think this is more the type of religion that I want to pursue. And at the time, I would have been 12 years old.
And you made that decision for yourself, which I think is so awesome.
Yes.
And just speaks to the freedom of thought then that you had found and discovered through reading and through those.
I was raised with my parents to have a lot of freedom of thought. Even though my grandparents were very strictly Christian and wanted me to be raised strictly Christian, my parents actually raised me to think for myself. And in fact, I was actually kidnapped briefly by my grandparents as a very young child as a result of this, but that's a totally separate story.
Yeah, that religious zealotry will really get you. It'll really get you. You'll do things that are very strange.
So I was, you know, I was reading Bullfinger's mythology, but I have there's this aspect to my personality where I'm always most fascinated by whatever is most obscure. So yeah. I never want the most easily accessible version of something. I don't know why. It's just some strange urge in my personality to always seek out the more obscure version of something. So even though I decided I wanted to be a pagan because of reading Bullfinch's mythology, I didn't want to practice Greco-Roman paganism because I could already tell from reading the book that that was the most popular type of mythology. I wanted to practice something more obscure. So I was inspired by the chapter on the Druids. Of course, I did not know at the time that Bullfinch really didn't know very much about the Druids. So I decided I wanted to pursue Celtic paganism. And that's what led me to go in that direction, even though at that time I knew absolutely nothing about it.
And I love that, you know, for most people, practicing paganism would be the extra thing. You know, it would be the less mainstream thing. But you went even further by saying, no, I'm not doing that mainstream paganism. I'm going to do this.
I always do that. And it's the most self-defeating aspect of my personality, honestly.
No, but it's great. That's hilarious. And so you started practicing at about 12. Where'd you find your information and your resources? I mean, I can imagine like in some places they would try and obscure it as much as possible. And you cover a little bit of that in your book about how pagans survived through periods of time where they were persecuted and where they tried to take in the hyper-Christianization of Europe, how they tried to take those identities from people. How did you kind of build that for yourself? And then how did you carry it into your life?
Well, initially, because I didn't have information on the type of paganism I was most interested in, this is when I was probably 12 to 13. I tried to make up my own mythology because I thought, since I can't find information on the type of mythology that I want to look into, I'll just come up with my own. So I came up with this entire pantheon of gods and myths and everything. And then over time, I started to, you know, I would check every public library that my parents would take me to. I would check every thrift store book sale that I was able to get to, and I was always looking for more information about the ancient Celts and ancient Celtic paganism. And when I finally found enough that I thought I knew a little bit about it, I stopped working with my own mythology and started just pursuing more Celtic mythology. Now, initially, I didn't, even though I thought I knew something about it, I still didn't, because a lot of the information that was out there was actually not reliable. Yeah. But for example, I read a book called The White Goddess by Robert Graves, who was a really excellent poet, but he was not really an excellent scholar. And so a lot of what he said about ancient paganism is just not factual, but I didn't know that at the time. So, you know, it took a lot of years of study before I finally really got a handle on what it was I was studying.
You're listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. I'm your host, Kat Sabotage, and this is Solidarity Spokane. We're going to have a couple messages, and then we will continue with our interview with author Christopher Scott Thompson on his book, Pagan Anarchism. Stay right where you are.
Woke up this morning, smiled at the rising sun. Three little birds sat on my doorstep, singing a sweet song.
Hi, I'm Charlotte, and I like dragonflies because I love the hilarious dad jokes and riddles. Tune into Dragonflies on Thin Air every Sunday at 3 on KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1
and 92.3 FM.
The This is your KYRS live and local calendar for August 24th through the 27th. Thursday, B at Magnolia American Brasserie, Aspen Kai at the District, Mr. Sister at Lucky You Lounge, and DJ Exodus at the Low Key. Friday, Jada, Lindsay Lee, Tyler Ali, and many others at Vibe Vintage, Moynock, Calvaria, Bone Mass, Propagate the Rot, and Locust Cathedral at the Big Dipper, and Touch of Evil, Burns Like Hellfire, and Tyler Acre at Pacific Avenue. Saturday, Rusty Jackson, Heather King, Joel Haugen, and many others at Beck's Harvest House, Rock the Block with Strangers, B-Radicals, Fat Lady, and others in the Garland District, Corazon de Maná, Las Faraones del Norte, Milonga, and many others at the Spokane Central Library, Ron Green, Who Do You Do, the Jason Perry Band, and others at the Brick West Plaza, and Sweetwater and Perusa at Lucky You Lounge. Sunday, Haunted Like Human at Big Barn Brewing, and Joey Anderson at Beck's Harvest House. For an entire hour of Spokane area musicians, tune in to For the Love of the Music. Catch Mel Dalton this Sunday night at 8 on KYRS.
The mission of Planned Parenthood is to ensure all people have access to the care and resources they need to make informed decisions about their bodies, their lives, and their futures. Each year, Planned Parenthood delivers vital reproductive health care, sex education, and information to millions of people in the United States and around the world. Information online at PlannedParenthood.org.
Hi, this is Jeremy Whittington from Stage Left Theater. KYRS, Thin Air Community Radio, provides our region with information that might be omitted, overlooked, or even censored by mainstream media. Your radio station is powered by the communities they serve, and our radio programs are as rich and diverse as the Spokane community itself. Please make a pledge today by texting GIVE KYRS to 44321. Your support ensures that KYRS can continue to celebrate the rich diversity of our community.
You're listening to Solidarity Spokane. I'm your host, Kat. And now let's get back to more of our interview with author Christopher Scott Thompson on his book, Pagan Anarchism. You're listening to Solidarity Spokane, KYRS Medical Lake Spokane. The paganism in the sense that I really wanted to know more about it. I wanted to delve into some of it, and I kind of got onto the Norse paganism. There's a lot of really good resources for that, but one of the things that they did mention that I found in studying that was that a ton of that was obscured long after Christianity started spreading up there and putting its tendrils into the ideas. And so it became, and because it was mostly oral, the passage of those cultures and those stories of an oral tradition, they kind of lost a lot of it, which is not a lot of it, but you know what I'm saying, to a point. It got obscured through the Christianization of Northern Scandinavia, and I found that to be really interesting.
Yeah, that's definitely true of the Celtic language-speaking areas as well. But there's another factor when it comes to Celtic areas, which is that Christianity was not spread to Ireland through violence. It was spread in a more like a cultural diffusion pattern. Mm-hmm. So the Irish paganism does not necessarily have the intense hostility between Christianity and paganism that you see in a lot of other histories.
So
there's a lot of Irish mythology that is sort of partly Christian and partly pagan.
And how does the, so here's the pivot, right? The book is called Pagan Anarchism. So
yeah,
how do the ideas of paganism align with the ideas of anarchism, and how do you see those two interplaying with each other?
Well, so I started to notice that there were other pagan anarchists back in probably 2011 when I was involved with the Occupy movement. Up until that, you know, I considered myself an anarchist for many, many years. But again, at that time, I didn't really know that much about anarchism or the history of anarchism, or I hadn't really read the top anarchist philosophers at that stage. So it was just more of a general stance that I had towards life. But in 2011, when I was involved with Occupy, I started to notice that there were a bunch of people who identified as both anarchists and pagans. I started to realize that there was this little kind of semi-underground movement. And then I started to think, you know, there is a deep connection between these ideas, because my paganism is partly a rejection of the modern world, because there are so many things about the world we live in now that are just fundamentally ugly and destructive.
Mm-hmm.
And there are so many things about pagan religion that seem to represent an antidote to everything that is so horrible about the world that we've built. Like the idea of seeing the world as being filled with life. And I mean, even objects we normally think of as inanimate, mm-hmm. to think of them as living things, as people in some sense. That animist worldview where everything that exists is something you can be in relationship with. And that kind of interconnected, interwoven type of spirituality, it's fundamentally pagan, but it also connects to anarchism potentially, in that it's a different way of viewing the world that is not compatible with modern capitalism in any way.
Mm-hmm.
Now, there are plenty of pagans who do support capitalism, but it's a contradiction for them to do so.
Yes, and you have a section of the book that talks specifically about that, about, you know, the ways that some of these ideologies, just because you're a pagan doesn't mean you're an anarchist, and just because you're an anarchist doesn't mean you're, you know, an anarcho-syndicalist or an anarcho-communist. You can be an anarcho-capitalist, sure. which makes almost as little sense as a pagan capitalist.
I mean, generally speaking, I would say that most other anarchists don't consider anarcho-capitalists to be anarchists at all, and right. I would agree with that assessment. I don't think of them as anarchists.
That idea of animism, too, is one of the most beautiful parts about your book, is viewing the world as a living and breathing thing, and viewing all of the things and spirits inside of it as beautiful, autonomous individuals. And you mention in your book a lot about St. Brigid. Am I saying that correct? St. Brigid?
Well, that's kind of a tough question to answer, because there's sort of a standard way of pronouncing the name in English, and it's totally different than how it's pronounced in Irish or in Scots Gaelic. So probably most people in English say Brigid, uh-huh. and then in Irish it's usually some version of Brigid or Brigid.
That's beautiful. Could you talk a little bit about that figure and what drew you to her specifically?
Sure. So Brigid is kind of a perfect combination of what I was saying, that in Irish paganism, which is a type of Celtic paganism, that there's some degree of overlap between the pagan past and Christianity, because originally Brigid was a goddess. She was part of the Irish pantheon of deities who are usually called the Tuatha De Danann. And she was the daughter of the Dagda, who is one of the leading gods in that pantheon. And the goddess Brigid was a triple goddess. She was sometimes represented as one figure and sometimes as three sisters. And the three sisters include a goddess of poetry, a goddess of healing, and a goddess of smithcraft.
Mm-hmm.
And Brigid appears in Irish mythology relatively briefly. She's discussed in passing in a few different texts, but the main story about her is about the death of her son Ruadan at the Second Battle of Moytura. And so she, in that text, is also kind of a figure that mourns the bloodshed of war, because her son dies in war, and it's said that she was the first person to invent keening, which is this kind of like crying out, weeping and moaning at a funeral that was part of Irish culture for many, many centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And we also know that this goddess Brigid was associated with fire, because Cormac's Glossary, which is a medieval Irish text, gives her the name Fiery Arrow. So we know that she was associated with fire.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you then have this Catholic saint, St. Brigid, who has a name that's derived from the name of the goddess. And the legends of St. Brigid constantly emphasize a connection to fire. And then she has various other points that overlap with the goddess Brigid. For one thing, she's strongly associated with healing. There is a great many healing charms in Irish and in Scots Gaelic that call upon St. Brigid. But in effect, you might argue they are also calling on the goddess Brigid, because the tradition of worshiping this figure named Brigid has endured from pagan times into the present. It's just that at one point this figure was identified as a goddess, For many centuries, she was then identified as a saint. And now in modern Ireland, it's quite common for people to describe her as both a saint and a goddess. In fact, the Brigidine nuns at Kildare to this day actually describe Bridget as simultaneously a saint and a goddess. So what drew me to Bridget is it's almost a sense of a contradiction. Mm-hmm. Because Bridget is an extraordinarily gentle and loving figure in most of the Irish mythology. Mm-hmm. And she's a figure that provides care and healing and generosity and all of these beautiful things that they're not necessarily at the forefront of my own personality. I would say that I'm kind of a little harsher than that. Mm-hmm. I would say that in some ways I'm a tough guy. And so Bridget is almost an opposite of my personality. And for some reason that draws me intensely to Bridget. Maybe it's that I feel that she balances out something that would otherwise be lacking in me. Mm-hmm. And focusing on Bridget, I pray to Bridget at least twice a day, sometimes several times a day. Mm-hmm. And that those prayers give me this wonderful feeling of being connected to this force that is loving and healing and is all about caring for other beings. And I don't know, it's just a beautiful feeling. And that feeling helps me be more that way in my daily life. Mm-hmm.
I love the way that you approach your practice of religion and the way you speak about it in your book, because it's very much a decision that you own personally and that you've done with like really great intent and intention. And you have such meaning in the things that you practice. And it's representative of just a really good level of consciousness and intention. So I wanted to thank you for bringing those ideas to the show, because they're really, really lovely.
Good. Go on.
No, I was going to say just a little bit more about, ask a question more about the way that pagan society has influenced or rather just kind of faded over time. And if you think that you believe human beings are intrinsically communal beings, like we seem like, especially in the idea of anarcho-syndicalism, this idea that you cannot stratify us the way that you have and expect us to have a natural life. Like it just, mm-hmm. something about the structure of our economic system and the structure of everything as it is seems so incredibly unnatural. I mean, do you feel that like a lot of the movement and the progressive movement underneath it is really trying to shuck off those kinds of constraints and return to a more, you know, communal and natural state of being that seems to have been taken from us?
I think that there are large elements of the movement that are trying to do that. I don't think everyone sees that as clearly or is on the same page with that. Because, for example, there are elements of the left that don't have any problem at all with industrial society, despite all of the destruction that the industrial world causes.
Right.
So I don't think everyone is on the same page with that. But I do think that there are major elements of the movement that are focused on that. The thing you said about seeing humans as fundamentally communal, this is kind of sparking some thoughts in me, because to me, it's almost impossible to see humans as individuals, as purely individuals and not as part of a community, without developing a completely destructive mindset, because we can't exist even for a single day without relying on other people. But our society, the way it's structured right now, constantly sends the message that it's supposed to be every man for himself, so to speak.
Right.
Every person for themselves. And that we're supposed to exist in constant predatory competition with each other. It's like the entire society. Yes, and it rewards that. And it's like the entire society encourages a mindset of sociopathy at all times. Mm-hmm. And to me, this focus on community is especially important, because I've always felt that I'm really very dissimilar to most other people that I meet. I don't think like most of the people that I run into in daily life. I've always felt like I'm not really like other people. Mm-hmm. Now, I could then respond to that by saying, okay, I'm this figure that stands alone off apart from society. But I refuse to do that because I don't think that's a healthy way to think for anybody. So I prefer to think of it as, you know, I'm an unusual person, but that's not really the important point. The important point is that I do have a society that I can fit into and contribute something to, and also that I receive so much support in different ways from. I would rather focus on the idea that I am connected to other people and not on the idea that I'm not connected to other people.
Yes. And I feel like we've been doing that and facing like a losing battle. I find myself feeling a lot of despair that I have to remind myself is not permanent. But when you kind of exist in our culture and have this idea that people really aren't for each other anymore, like the simple gestures that I, like today I was walking by the store and there was an old guy who was just walking up to the front of the store. And he had a cane, and his scoliosis was so bad, he was bent over, you know, almost in half. And I just watched like five or six different people just walk past him as he struggled to push this cart up a very, very shallow incline, you know, in front of the yeah. store. And there were just people passing, just, you know, super fast around him, looking at their phone or something. And I mean, I just asked him, you know, can I get that for you? And he said, and he was relieved. He's like, oh, you sure can. Thanks. And he went and he's like hobbled back to his car, you know, but like, is that so hard? You know,
I'm guessing that most of those people weren't really that consciously aware that he was there because they were focused on other things.
Right. Right. But this society that we're in, it very much kind of like reinforces that idea. Like it's you, you're out for yourself. You got to go out there. And I mean, you know, the stereotypical thing is getting stuck in traffic and people just get so angry at each other in traffic when we're all trying to achieve the same thing, which is get to where we're going alive, you know, and with as little stress as possible. But that idea that we're all on our own, and now it's having us commodify our images and our bodies to sell on TikTok or on Instagram, and is, you know, rewarding that and pushing that. I mean, where do you find your hope in all of that?
So I'm going to refer now to something that happened in Minneapolis. You know, the uprising that happened in 2020. Mm-hmm. For a period of about a year, George Floyd Square, which is the neighborhood immediately around where George Floyd was murdered by the police, George Floyd Square was barricaded off from the rest of the city and maintained as an autonomous zone. And that is still true to some extent, but for about a year, the barricades were actually maintained by volunteers that would stay out on the barricades day and night, you know, pulling them open to let certain vehicles in and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
So the neighborhood was really, it really functioned autonomously, and it was self-governed. The community that lived in George Floyd Square governed themselves with a meeting in the morning and in the evening. And so it was, you know, essentially a functioning anarchy for a period of time. And again, it still is to some extent. Mm-hmm. And when I was one of the volunteers who was helping on the barricades at George Floyd Square, I was talking to somebody who lived in the neighborhood one night. My shift helping out at the barricades usually went from, I think it was 9 p.m. till midnight most of the time. So I was out there quite late at night. Mm-hmm. I was talking to somebody who was out from the neighborhood, but they were sitting out at the barricades talking to us. And the person said that the biggest difference for him about George Floyd Square was the fact that traffic didn't normally go through there, and that that had completely changed his daily life because suddenly he knew all of his neighbors. And that he had never really known his neighbors or had any relationship with them. But when cars stopped constantly going through the square because it was barricaded, only occasional very local vehicles came through, mm-hmm. He started to actually be out on the street with the people he lived around. And he got to know a whole ton of people he hadn't known before. And after a little while, he would start to go and knock on a neighbor's door if he needed to, like, borrow a cup of sugar or whatever. And he felt a sense of connection to his community that he had never experienced before when it was functioning like an ordinary neighborhood. So that comment really struck me. and gave me a lot of hope, because what that says to me is that people are capable of spontaneously building and experiencing real community very rapidly when the circumstances are right again. So if the circumstances that we live in change and people are once again in a position where it's possible for them to have real community, it's not that they have forgotten how. They'll be able to do it again immediately.
How do you believe that we get back to those communities? You said ordinary neighborhood, and what's sad is that I knew what you meant, which is that an ordinary neighborhood is so devoid of community, you know, like the neighborhoods that we think of. I mean, and it's disappearing, and it's making it harder for us to feel like we're part of communities. I mean, what would you...
You know, I wouldn't want to make that comment about George Floyd Square, because I don't live in George Floyd Square. Uh-huh. So for all I know, the people who live there have maybe many of them have always felt that they had a strong community, but this particular person didn't feel it until the barricades were up. So I don't want to make an overly broad statement.
Yes.
In any case, what I'm going to say next, it's a little harsh, because the situation we're in right now worldwide is obviously dire. Mm-hmm. I don't think that we can get back to that across the board for everybody without consciously making revolutionary change. And I don't think that we're ready to consciously make revolutionary change. I don't see the will there to make it. Mm-hmm. So if we don't create that revolutionary change, then circumstances will create it for us, and we will not have as much control over it that way. Mm-hmm. If circumstances create it for us, what I mean by that is that climate change is going to cause increasingly severe disasters until society as we know it is no longer capable of functioning. Mm-hmm. When society as we know it is no longer capable of functioning, then people will have no choice but to live in real communities again, because there won't be any other way that they and their neighbors can survive. So to me, the way that people are going to get community back is it's essentially going to be forced upon them by the circumstances that we've created by not taking the common sense steps that would have prevented the disasters that we're now facing.
I do have to say that does not sound great. And it does sound a little harsh. But I have found myself believing the same thing that you said, is that there is a machine that's functioning to exploit and withdraw resources from our planet. And it has been set loose for so long and has so much inertia and momentum that we might just find ourselves having to adapt to the consequences that are the making of those institutions.
At the same time, there is no way to know, because when revolutions happen, they're always very unexpected events. Mm-hmm. And that's true even of smaller semi-revolutionary situations like the uprising in 2020. Nobody expected a huge nationwide uprising to happen. It took everyone, like radicals were just as taken by surprise by it as everybody else was. Mm-hmm. So that's also been true historically of major revolutions. You know, there might have been a general sense that things couldn't keep going this way for much longer, but probably nobody involved in storming the Bastille thought that the French Revolution would happen as a result. So it is possible that people will come to their senses and decide to prevent the destruction of the planet that we live on and collectively put a stop to the nonsense that we've been living with. I don't see it happening right now, but it's impossible to know for sure that it won't.
Taking a little bit of a pivot from that, there's mm-hmm. so much overwhelming energy and negativity that comes from our modern society and the trajectory that we're on. Where do you go to find the connection to the spirits that you practice with, or that you feel connected to? How do you make your space?
So that's a little complicated to answer, because effectively I have two totally different spiritual practices that layer on top of each other. It's not accurate to say they're totally different, but two different spiritual practices that layer on top of each other. One of them is Celtic paganism, and that is, or to be more specific, Irish or Gaelic paganism. Celtic is a broader term. Mm-hmm. And that is something I practice through a set of repeated daily practices, saying specific prayers in Gaelic and celebrating holy days such as Samhain or Lunasa. And then the other practice is much more personal and is kind of, in a sense, going back to what I did when I was 12 or 13. It's much more like my own mythology. not the same one I created when I was 12 or 13, but it's very personal. And those practices are, they're mostly based on meditation of a type. You could visualization meditation, shall we say. Mm-hmm. And those visualization meditations, you know, I can perform those by lying down in my bed with all the lights off in the room. I don't need a huge amount of physical space to practice them. But I understand what you were actually asking me about was more, where do I find the mental or spiritual space to practice them? Mm-hmm. And I don't actually find it to be particularly challenging to do that. But that's partly because those personal spirits that I work with, they're on the dark side. They're aesthetically dark. So the fact that the world is filled with dark feelings does not necessarily keep me from accessing those spirits.
Right. And it allows you to find them in everyday life. I mean, and in the things that you experience as you move through your day to day.
That's accurate. I feel the presence of the spirits that I work with. I feel their presence on a continuous, ongoing basis.
How do we explain to people that you're an anarchist? You know, when you meet someone who's just kind of like, you know, atypically minded, who kind of sees the world in black and white structures. I mean, how do you approach somebody if they ask you, or if it comes up in conversation? How do you mention, you know, that you're an anarchist or that you're a pagan? I mean, I imagine you've experienced some kind of, I want to say, what's the word I'm looking for? You know, like negativity, maybe, from that, where somebody like comes to you and they say, they're like, what? You know, I don't know what
you
mean.
Well, I get a lot more negativity about being an anarchist than about being a pagan.
Isn't that interesting?
Even when I talk about religion with Christians, they usually are not openly confrontational about me being pagan.
Yeah.
But being an anarchist, there's something about being an anarchist that actually seems to make people angry. And if anything, it makes liberals more angry than it makes conservatives. And I've never really totally understood that.
Right.
Before the Trump regime began, I used to find it easier to have friends that I really disagreed with politically. So if I had a friend that I could talk about interesting things with, but their political views were more conservative, you know, we maybe wouldn't talk about politics all the time. We would talk about the other things. Ever since Trump, that's essentially been impossible because everything has become much more hostile, and you don't necessarily feel safe around friends who have views that are very different from yours.
Right.
And also you don't necessarily feel good about talking with them when you know that their beliefs lead them to reject people that you love and people that are part of your family and people that are, you know, part of your friend group. Mm-hmm. But, you know, in the past, when I would have friends who were more conservative and who were, you know, traditional Catholics or Christian in some other way, they usually would just find it interesting that I was pagan, and they would ask me questions about it that were more curious than anything else. Mm-hmm. And they also usually would not be openly hostile about me being anarchist. If anything, they would be kind of curious and questioning about it. But when I talk with people that identify as liberals and I mention that I'm an anarchist, I will often get an openly aggressive response, and I don't totally understand that.
It feels like that happens too in the acceptance of any kind of progressive ideology when it comes to liberals. I mean, it's like it's threatening to their order as much as, you know, fascism would be. Like, they just want to live in this middle ground. But, you know, the neoliberal things, the neoliberal ideas of the 20th century have got us on the track to fascism. So you can't just say that you're going to just exist in that middle space forever, you know?
I feel like if I was going to be completely frank with them, I would say, look, what you believe has been tried and it manifestly did not work.
Right. And we're seeing a slide into the consequences of all of that. And, you know, you keep trying to pull us back to the middle and tell us that, you know, our ideas are crazy. But maybe the idea that people, you know, have to live in dwellings that are owned by someone else who owns 20 that look like it is actually crazy. And maybe we're not.
Well, I mean, so I'll sometimes use this metaphor talking about conservatives and liberals, not conservatives and liberals as general tendencies, because it's not always like this. But in our country right now, a conservative is like a person that is driving at 80 miles an hour towards a brick wall. Mm-hmm. And a liberal is like a person who says, no, let's slow down to 60.
I've never heard that, but I love it. But it's entirely true. The end is still a brick wall, but at least...
The end is still a brick wall at high speed, so it's going to end the same exact way. But,
oh, I love that.
Yeah. So it's not all liberals, though. Like, the other thing I've noticed is that you will sometimes see, if you're at a big event and there are anti-fascists there and there are also progressive liberals, you know, a whole range of people there, you'll sometimes get this really positive reaction from the liberals in the crowd towards the anti-fascists. They do seem to sometimes be able to understand that you have to fight fascism. And as far as that goes, I would say that I will stand side by side with anybody who's willing to fight fascism. That includes socialists, communists, liberals, anybody.
And that's so healthy because the left is so often divided. You know, they've managed to successfully pit trade unions against each other for decades and decades. They pit socialists against anarchists, and they pit everyone against everybody. And then we're all trying to mass together. I will say that the right has one thing that I envy them for, and that's the ability to function as an autonomous whole. And it doesn't seem to matter if that means that they completely, you know, they will throw their own philosophies and ideas under the bus as soon as they're no longer popular, and they are like a united front. It's terrifying, and sometimes I find myself despairing, and I want more people to have your kind of outlook, which is I will stand next to anybody who is fighting that and who is standing up to that, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we have any choice. Like, if we don't come together to resist fascism, then we're literally all dead.
Yeah. Yeah. And not in a figurative sense, but in the actual terminus, we will destroy our planet and we will all perish.
Yeah.
I want to ask you what you think you would tell folks who are interested in exploring the ideas of paganism and anarchism, and how you would say to go about exploring those ideas and just thinking about them and maybe studying them. It can be intimidating.
Well, so going back to my book, there's a chapter that sort of goes into a very broad history of paganism. And then there's a chapter that goes into a very broad history of anarchism. So what you could do as a sort of a way in to learn about it, if you're interested but you don't know much yet, is to read those chapters closely and to take notes about the things I'm referring to, because I mentioned different books in them that are all good starting points. So, for example, in the chapter on anarchism, I'll mention a particular anarchist thinker like Kropotkin and his most famous book, The Conquest of Bread. Well, you know, The Conquest of Bread is a book that you can easily find and read. So it's a way that you can start learning about anarchist thinking. And I mentioned the history of the Spanish Civil War. There are many histories of the Spanish Civil War. In fact, there are many written from an anarchist perspective. And, you know, just start picking up books and reading. You won't be able to get a handle on the big picture immediately. You have to give yourself some time to absorb it and learn more. When it comes to the pagan side, I would include a caution, because there are a lot of books with unreliable information about pagan religion. And when I say unreliable, I mean the book might say that there's a particular deity from a particular culture, but that culture in fact has never believed in such a deity, and the author more or less made that up. So you need to be cautious of sources when it comes to pagan materials. But I can mention, for Irish paganism, I can mention a few authors whose work you can rely on. Morgan Daimler is somebody whose work you can rely on for Irish paganism, and Laura O'Brien is somebody whose work you can rely on for Irish paganism. Now,
you're listening to Solidarity Spokane. I'm your host, Kat Sabotage. We have run out of time. I had a little bit of technical issues running the board here today and getting the file up and running. In the last portion of this interview, which is just about 4 to 5 minutes, Christopher Scott Thompson goes on to describe his two latest works, The Book of Oni and An Entomonian Dream Grimoire. He speaks about that book and talks about the processes by which he helps you visualize and achieve your own state of meditative practice. If you're interested in more of Christopher Scott Thompson's work, I would highly encourage you to go online and look him up, Christopher Scott Thompson. We've been discussing his book, Pagan Anarchism, and he has a later one coming out, The Book of Oni, an Antinomian Dream Grimoire. I apologize for having to cut the interview a little bit short. We had some unforeseen hiccups, but I appreciate the time that you spent with us. As always, I'm your host, Kat Sabotage. You've been listening to KYRS Medical Lake Spokane, 88.1 and 92.3 FM. A full cut of this interview will be available on the show page, so please check that out. And there will be a rebroadcast 2 weeks from today so I can get that entire interview in there. Have a great week, and remember, dump the bosses off your back.